one of the mistakes that we've made over the last couple of decades is to assume that liberal democracy was inevitable, that because it was obviously the best system, that we didn't have to work that hard on it, you know, and that we could allow politics to be done by just a bunch of professional people over there, and the rest of us could get on with whatever, making money or writing books.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to another edition of Liberal Half Hour, Liberal Halvtime in Norwegian. My name is Erik Løkke, and in this episode, I am speaking with Anne Applebaum about liberal democracy, or more precisely, liberal democracy under siege and the rise of authoritarianism, which is the central focus in her award-winning book, Twilight of Democracy, Demokratiets Svanesang in Norwegian. Today's episode is a recorded talk I had with Anne earlier this year at the House of Literature in Bergen. So let me extend my gratitude to the House of Literature in Bergen for the chance to facilitate the conversation with Anne, and moreover, the chance to publish it as part of Civita podcast Liberal Halvtime. During my conversation with Anne, we talked about what happened to liberal democracy and why do many people get attracted to authoritarian ideas and the different threats in different countries from anti-democratic forces. I'm talking about anti-democratic forces. It is impossible to ignore Donald Trump and the Republican Party. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Anne Applebaum. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome. We are live streaming from the House of Literature in Bergen, and we have titled today's event, Democracy in Freefall, where we will discuss the status and challenges for liberal democracy. My name is Erik Løkke. I'm a fellow at the Norwegian think tank Civita, and I'm honored to be joined by Anne Applebaum, author of the recent book, Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lore of Authoritarianism. In Norwegian, Demokratiets Svanesang. Anne is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author and one of the leading intellectuals of our time. Indeed, Anne was one of the very first who shed light on the Russian involvement in the US election in 2016. Anne is joining me from New York. And let me start, Anne, by wishing you a very warm welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you, even if it's only virtually, you know, maybe next time in person.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, due to the pandemic, I hope I can stop saying those words very soon. My first question, a pretty obvious question. Why a book about liberal democracy and why now?
So my book really evolved out of a series of personal experiences. It was a reflection on what had happened to a group of friends of mine. I actually start the book with a New Year's Eve party, at a moment of high hopes and a lot of optimism about liberal democracy, which is the year 1999, 10 years after 1989, and a time when, we all thought, the party was in Poland, which is where I lived part of the time, and the party was full of people who had expectations that Poland would be a democracy, that it would integrate with Europe. There was a lot of belief in markets and freedom and enthusiasm for that going forward. Two decades later, many of the people at that party are no longer speaking to many of the other people at that party. And this is a phenomenon that you can find certainly all across the center right, and I'm told the center left in many European, and North American democracies as well, in that a part of what was the old liberal, alliance, the establishment, whatever words you want to use, whatever is the old consensus, a part of the people who were central to that have now gone in a different direction and have become much more attracted to radical ideas, to more extreme ideas, much more doubtful about the need or use of democratic institutions. And some of them have now worked for political parties or journals or newspapers that actively seek to undermine them, whether it's undermining the rule of law, whether it's undermining the independence of the courts, or whether, as in the United States, as you saw last January, it's actually stopping the process of the constitutional process of selecting the president. And the book simply attempts to explain why that happened and how, and also seeks to show that it's happening in many different countries at the same time. And so the need for the book was just, as I said, it began out of my awareness that my sort of local issues or the divisions among former friends of mine represented something more universal, that there was a turning away from a disgust with, a disappointment with modern democracy, and that required some explanation. And I should say, I mean, I'm sure we'll go on to talk about this. The book doesn't give you one simple answer. I try to answer it in different ways. I'm looking at some people's personal views, personal life experiences, in some cases, ideological or political experiences. So there are a number of different explanations for why this is happening now.
Mm. And it's very interesting reading your book and how your own story is connected with the democratic development in Poland and the US. And looking back at the party in 99, in hindsight, were there some obvious signs that some of these people were, so to speak, going in an authoritarian direction? Were you surprised? And how do you look at it 20 years later?
So I think as with this, so, in my book, I explained that the party was, although there were some American and British guests there, it was largely Polish. And it was roughly what you would say was the Polish center right, you know, sort of anti-communists, people who'd been anti the communist government, who'd worked for the opposition, mostly as younger people or as journalists or nobody famous or important. It was just a milieu. And, you know, in Poland, as in so many other places, politics are coalition. And the coalition that was created to fight communism contained a wide range of people in it, on the people who you would say were right, left, center on their economics. They had different views about religion and the role of religion in public life. Maybe they had different views about foreign policy or geopolitics. But nevertheless, they were all in this, you know, in this anti-communist coalition together. And when that was the subject, when that was the, you know, what was important, you know, then we were all able to work together. And the fact that we had differences on other issues didn't emerge. And so, for example, we weren't discussing Syrian refugees coming to Europe in 1999 because it wasn't an issue on the table. And it would only be, you know, 18 years later, you know, and which they had very different views about. And you can look at, there's a very similar story in the U.S., namely that in the U.S., the kind of what you could roughly call Reaganism or Reagan Republicanism was, again, a coalition. I mean, you know, why were people cold warriors in America? Well, some of them were realpolitik people who were afraid of Russian power or they worried about nuclear weapons. Some people were interested in democracy and human rights. Some people were interested in religion because communism promoted atheism, and so they felt they had a religious obligation to fight the Cold War. And then what happened in the two decades following that is that coalition discovered they felt differently about a lot of other issues. So no, I don't think it was possible to say in 1989 or even 1999 exactly what direction people would go or what would happen when new kinds of issues were presented to them. And this is, by the way, I also explained in the book, I mean, this is normal in politics, you know, the reshaping of coalitions and the in the way in which different issues divide society in complete, you know, can be unexpected is something that happens periodically. And it was actually the realization that I had lived through one of these moments, you know, when there's this great ideological shift that made me write the book. But you know, in the book I talk about, for example, the era of the Dreyfus trial in France. This was a case of Alfred Dreyfus, who was a Jewish French army officer who was accused of treason, as it turned out, unjustly. But his case divided French society, including people who'd all been on the same side for a long time. They had been, you know, they were militarists, they were pro-army, and then suddenly they discovered they felt differently about these questions of justice and who is French, and who deserves the protection of law and who doesn't. And something like that, I think, has happened in our time, that there's just been the political coalitions have shifted. And that's normal. So looking back in 1999, you wouldn't necessarily have picked out who was going to go in which direction. I mean, I suppose there were clues in some cases, but it wasn't obvious.
Mm. Obviously, I think most Norwegians follow American politics much more closely than Polish. Certainly I do. So if you could just give a brief status of the situation in Poland and what are the dominant issues there and how does it compare to the US? Are there similarities, differences?
So you should pay attention to Poland. It's a lot closer to you than the U.S. I believe there are a lot of Poles working in Norway now. It's a country that, you know, you have even some, I mean, there's sort of northern Poland is quite Scandinavian in its thinking and its orientation. So you have some, you have more in common culturally and even I think in terms of cuisine than you think. Northern Polish coast is very, Baltic coast is, you know, same food as Scandinavia. So Poland is right now ruled by a radical right party, which has become more radical in recent years. It was not always what it is today. And one of the things it has sought to do since first attaining power is to use the fact that it was democratically elected to change the rules so that it won't lose again. And this has involved an attack on the court system, a replacement of a series of judges in an unconstitutional manner, changing the nature of Poland's Supreme Court. And just so that you understand how extreme this is, because, you know, court, it sounds a little boring, you know, court reform or judicial issues. Some months ago, it turned out that inside the Justice Ministry, there was a trolling operation. So an online campaign being run by an anonymously by secret people that was focused on judges who weren't going along with the government. So if you're a judge who doesn't agree with the government's judicial reform or who has issues with the government on other issues, you can be targeted and attacked and smeared, and you can also, you know, they can't fire everybody, but you could be moved from Warsaw to the provinces. You could be punished in other ways by formally or informally by the Justice Ministry itself. You know, so you have to understand that trolling campaigns run out of the Justice Ministry focused on judges. This is the kind of, the kind of policy we have, which is kind of unheard of and unthinkable in any previous era in Polish history. So they try to smear you, they try to eliminate you. And this is, of course, done to political opponents of the government as well. So attack on the judges, an attempt to undermine the free press, mostly not by outright censorship, but by, for example, putting pressure on companies not to advertise in free media, in independent media, try to persuade owners of independent media to sell, lending money to state companies so that the state company buys from foreign owners, media groups, as a way of making sure that trying to increase the government's ownership of media and then to control what is said and what is heard. So these are known tactics. This was what was done in Russia to take control of the media. This is what Erdogan did in Turkey. This is what Viktor Orban did in Hungary. It's not unheard of in other countries, you know, for government to use their power to try and destroy the independent press. And that's also one of the things that we're living with now. And then I would say the third thing to be aware of is that we now have genuine political prisoners in Poland, in the sense that people can be targeted, usually on some kind of false corruption story, and arrested and then held under arrest indefinitely, awaiting the case before any evidence has been produced. And people can be accused of things that they aren't given the evidence and they don't understand what they've been accused of and held. And we have a close friend of ours was very nearly the target of one of these things. He's now out of the country, but I mean, he in effect lives abroad because he's afraid to return to Poland. This is a Polish lawyer. He's not directly in politics. He was in the past, but he accumulated some evidence about very high level government corruption. And so this is, these are all tactics known to us, again, Russia, Turkey, Hungary, but they are unfolding. And the difference in Poland is that we do have a very big and powerful opposition, numerous opposition anyway, that is opposed to this and is seeking to push back against it. So it's not a unanimous, the government doesn't even represent a majority anymore. It really never did. It's something like their support is now down to about 30%, the party. Nevertheless, because they control all these levers, they may have ways of staying in power. But this is the way in which democracy is now often assaulted, not in the old-fashioned way. So we're not living in an era of coup d'etat, you know, where there's tanks in the streets and, you know, the kinds of photographs that you can imagine from the past. But instead, we have democratically elected leaders who seek to undermine their own institutions in order to benefit themselves. And that was, in that sense, in that sort of narrow sense, Poland is very like America. I mean, that was what Trump tried to do while in office. He did try to change the rules. He did try to protect himself and hide corruption and change the rules to benefit himself while in power, rather than preserving this, you know, this even playing field that you need to maintain democratic, you know, so a kind of equal, you know, possibility for others to be elected. And you know, in another sense, it's also very similar in that we have in Poland this very deep polarization where one part of the country now only watches state media, which is extremely biased, very one-sided, very xenophobic, sometimes anti-Semitic. And then you have others who read the independent media who see a completely different world. And this is very similar to the U.S., where you have people in the Fox News far right, you know, social media bubble on the one hand, and then you have others in other bubbles. So, and you have very little shared public space. You don't really have a public sphere anymore that everybody participates in, and where at the very least everyone agrees on, you know, what happened yesterday. You know, so, you know, what, you know, the problem isn't that people will have different opinions because they've always had different opinions. The problem is that the facts, you know, themselves become different. And this is terribly damaging for democracy because democracy requires some accepted, there has to be some accepted sphere. There have to be accepted facts that we can debate and discuss if we're to regulate them or if we're to pass laws about them or if we're to agree about the kind of country that we're talking about. Mm. And so in that sense, very, I see a lot of similarities between what has happened in Poland and what was happening in the US.
Yeah, I think we're going to move to the US very soon. But just let me ask you, Anne, two questions. First, how safe is it for you to operate in Poland? And how many of the people who attended the party in 99 is active in the government today?
So I feel fairly safe. I mean, for a number of reasons, as you know, as I explained in the book, my husband was in politics before. He's now a member of the European Parliament. You know, we're I don't know, maybe it's an illusion, but I feel that we're well known enough and protected enough that I feel perfectly happy to speak it. And I should say, our part of Poland where we live, which is the western part of the country, is very anti-government. We're surrounded by people who, you know, are very anti-government. There's a very strong and loud opposition, which is not yet cowed. So it's not like I have no friends. On the contrary, we feel very supported and we feel very connected to a lot of other people, both in Poland and around the world. So I don't feel safe, but I can imagine that others who aren't as well known or whose jobs might be at risk if they speak out, I can imagine that other people are frightened. There's certainly a lot of fear in the business community, for example, in Poland, to say anything public that could get them in trouble, you know, because, you know, the government, you know, as in any smaller country, this is a little bit different in the United States, but as in any smaller country, you know, a small country, heavily centralized government, control over all kinds of rules about whatever, tenders or competitions or import export. I mean, they can make life difficult for business people, and so business people are very cautious about what they say. As for the people who are at the party, I don't think any of them are in the current government as politicians, but a number of them are leading journalists in what I can only describe as the far right media, and some are very loud xenophobes. One of them is famous anti-Semite. Several of them have attacked us personally, you know, so yes, some of them, I mean, most of the book is really about not political leaders. So it's not about the Trumps and the Kaczynskis and the Orbans. It's about the journalists, the speechwriters, the people who do, you know, social media monitoring, you know, the campaigners. It's about all the people, the sort of intellectuals and journalists and thinkers who have gathered around these far right leaders, because those are the people that I know. And their role is often underestimated, actually. I mean, there's a, you know, it is incorrect to imagine that all the intellectuals are on one side and everybody else is somehow not an intellectual on the other side. No, on the contrary, I mean, there are quite a lot of important you know, right and radical right intellectuals, journalists, thinkers who've done a lot, you know, for the benefit of the far right in Poland and all across Europe, and every far right party in Europe.
Mm. So what you're basically talking about is some of the enablers of the current situation. And you discussed this in your book. Why do people get attracted to authoritarian ideas? I mean, intellectuals and others. And could you say something about what do you think people are attracted to authoritarian ideas?
So, I mean, because I give a lot of, you know, nuanced explanations in the book, I don't want to be over simple here, but I will say usually it's born out of some form of really profound disappointment. So either it's a political disappointment. My country is going in a direction, you know, that I fear is downhill. I don't think it can be stopped. I don't think, you know, our society is disintegrating. You know, our civilization is falling apart, and people are in such despair about what they think is happening that they become attracted to. I mean, this is what radicalism has always been, whether it's on the left or on the right, is, you know, when you come to the conclusion that your society is so far gone and so ruined and so beyond repair, you know, then that's when you say, well, maybe it needs to be smashed up. You know, you get this Bolshevik desire to smash it all up and start from scratch. And some of it comes from that kind of, you know, almost millenarian despairing thinking about the present. Sometimes it's got an economic element. Sometimes it's demographic. You know, the demographic changes are changing my country in such a way that I find it to be unrecognizable. Sometimes it's the nature of modern, you know, of the modern economy. You know, sometimes it's sociological. Sometimes it's to do with the changes wrought by feminism or by, you know, other kinds of sociological change. So that's one piece of it. And then sometimes it's personal. There are some people I describe in the book who saw in these, you know, radical breaks in these radical movements saw opportunities for themselves. So if you were a Polish journalist who wasn't doing too well in the old system, and you were suddenly presented with the possibility of being a real star if you were part of this radical right newspaper, then that was an incentive to do it. And most people, I would say, have mixed motives. I mean, there are one or two people I think are totally cynical and who hitch themselves to radical movements in order to, you know, to make a career. But quite a lot of people are both. I mean, they have both personal and political reasons why they turn against democracy, you know, turn against the political systems that they live in.
Mm. A very popular idea is to blame liberal elites or so-called liberal elites. I mean, that's been some of the criticism towards you as well in the book, that you don't see the role of liberal elites across Europe, the debate of Brexit and in the US. What role do you think liberal elites or economic explanations has?
So first of all, you have to explain to me who you mean by liberal elites. You know, there are elites on both sides. I mean, my book is about the right-wing elites who went to the same universities, speak the same number of languages, and are, you know, earn the same amount of money as the liberal elites, and are very often, they all know it. I mean, it's not a coincidence. They know one another. And also remember, it's they who invented the term liberal elites to describe their friends, you know, or their high school classmates or their college classmates. And so I don't like the term much. You know, certainly there were other things going wrong in our democracies that the right has taken advantage of. I mean, I think the you know, again, this differs a little in different countries, but the role that money played in politics created a lot of cynicism, especially in the U.S. I think that in some ways it's true that demographic change, when it happened very rapidly, didn't give people time to adjust, or wasn't always well thought through. And it's true. I mean, the role of economics is a complicated one because, you know, I believe, for example, that the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 really was a big turning point, because that was the moment when for a lot of people around the world actually stood back and said, wait, these bankers have no idea what they're doing. I mean, you know, we had a lot of faith in the people who are running the financial system that it's very, okay, they're making a lot of money, but at least they, they're in control of this very complicated global economy. And it turned out that they weren't. And I think that was a big moment when people, you know, when people lost their faith in, you know, in whatever you want to call it, the financial class or the ruling financial elite. You know, nevertheless, the sort of revolt against the system didn't happen in 2008 and 2009. It happened some years later, you know, 7 or 8 years later, at a moment when the economy had recovered. And many of the both the leaders and the followers of these movements are not necessarily the poorest people in society. So the economic explanation that we all want, you know, because all of us nowadays are instinctive Marxists in that we all want to see an economic explanation for everything because an economic explanation always has an economic solution, you know, that we can pass a law or change the tax system and fix it. I think, unfortunately, it doesn't explain. It explains a part of the, you know, the populist authoritarian revolt, but not all of it. And so in Poland, it doesn't explain it at all. So because you have a country where there had been economic progress for 30 years, where every social class had improved their status, where everybody was better off than their parents. And yet you had this, you know, you had this support for populist authoritarianism. The same is true in the U.S., where the poorest Americans did not vote for Donald Trump. Quite a lot of middle-class Americans did vote for Donald Trump. And so you need to explain that. You know, you know, simple Marxism, you know, this is the poor revolting against the rich, does not explain Trumpism. When you begin to look at it a bit more carefully, you can, there are other kinds of interesting patterns. I mean, so there is a rural-urban pattern or a provincial cosmopolitan pattern where there are people who feel somehow, you know, somehow displaced or left out by urban, the more successful or not even, it's not even about financial success, the more, you know, the more the places in their country that have more status. So, you know, if you live in rural Pennsylvania, you know, you know, people in New York seem like they live on another planet because they have different status. They have a different way of living. They have a different way of speaking. And the resentments between rural and urban and sort of provincial and cosmopolitan, I think, explain more than simple money. I mean, if you look at the Brexit vote, for example, which is a slightly different version of this in the UK, there were a lot of wealthy people who voted for Brexit, but they tended to be people who lived in the countryside. I mean, I knew very number of them, but, you know, very well-off people in large country houses who were in no way threatened by immigrants and were in no way economically threatened by the European Union, nevertheless voted for Brexit as a, you know, as a kind of cry against whatever the globalization or the loss of, you know, English status or whatever it was that they feared. So if you look at those differences and those distinctions, you know, that makes more sense. I mean, also in Europe, you have sort of layered on top of the urban rural split, you often have EU, non-EU. So the EU is seen as being something that people in Paris and London and Warsaw and Prague like, whereas we people in, Debrecen and Białystok, you know, we feel left out by this. So there's some, actually Białystok's not even a good example because in Poland there's an odd thing where it's not just the big cities. All the cities, small cities, medium-sized cities, are led by opposition figures, not from the ruling party. And the countryside is very much ruling party. But anyway, in any case, the EU thing was often layered on top of that. So resentment against the EU is sometimes also resentment against urban areas and, you know, people who are seen as having a more cosmopolitan or less national lifestyle.
Mm. You already touched upon it in the US, and obviously Trump has been so much discussed, probably too much, but I still can't help myself and asking, looking back at the 2016 election, how surprised were you when Donald Trump became the president of the US?
So by the time he won, I was not surprised. I did think it was very shocking. The shocking moment to me was when the Republican Party appointed him as their candidate, you know, because that was the moment when you realized how much the Republican Party had changed. But as the election wore on and as we got closer to the end, I did think there was a possibility he would win. I was pretty sure Brexit would win as well. So I was not surprised. I mean, I don't know, shocked. I mean, it was not a good moment. But I wasn't totally surprised. I mean, the change happened within the Republican Party, it happened there first. And that was then, but anyway, the 2016 election dynamics were complicated by a number of factors. I mean, one, the unpopularity of Hillary Clinton. Another, it was the first time that it wasn't just the Russians using American social media, but it was also people working for the Trump campaign. It was the first time that we saw, this truly negative use of social media in shaping people's views and using it to deliberately create polarization and division. So, and those kinds of tactics we now see being used all over the world, as it happened, I'd seen them used already in Ukraine in 2014. So I was more attuned to them. But that new way of using social media came as a surprise to a lot of Americans.
Mm. And talking about the Republican Party, again, looking back at the 2016, the elites of the Republican Party was very much against Trump. And also in the primaries, he had like between 35 and 40%. So the fact that you had so many different candidates didn't be able to have one candidate who could go against Trump. But somehow Trump managed to take over the Republican Party. How much did that surprise you?
The party mismanaged it. They mismanaged their primary. There were far too many people. And I mean, this is an old story. I don't know how interesting it is anymore. And they lost control of the process. And instead, they allowed it to become a kind of, one of those celebrity Big Brother programs, who gets let off the island first. I mean, it was literally like that. The debates became very silly. They became, who gets kicked off the stage before the other one. And people participated in it like that. They were watching a bunch of people playing celebrity knockout or whatever you call it in Norway. I'm sure you have some version of these programs. And they allowed it to become that, and it didn't. And it was to do with the way the questions were being asked and so on. And they didn't, the party didn't take control of the process something similar happened to the Democratic side as well. The Democrats, they didn't exactly rig it so that Hillary would win, but they didn't. It felt so much like she'd had it wrapped up in advance that others, including, for example, Joe Biden, didn't run. And that was a mistake as well.
But again, looking back at what central figures within the Republican Party, I mean, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Lindsey Graham, they were harsh in their critique of Trump. I mean, they were criticizing, like you and many others did, of Trump, and suddenly they turned. What happened?
They turned because they thought their voters had turned too, and these are people who want, who want to be elected, and they understood that this was the, they thought anyway that this was the language that would win. Remember that the U.S. electoral system, I mean, this is not so true of the presidency, but it is skewed towards partisanship. I mean, this is, you ask, there are many, I don't know how interesting it is to a Norwegian audience. I mean, there are many deeper problems with the U.S. system right now. But one of them is that the way our electoral districts are gerrymandered, meaning the way they've been drawn, means that it's much easier to win in the House of Representatives as a very harsh partisan. And most people have very little incentive to be centrists or to try and win a broad selection of votes. What they need to do is to win their own party. And if what you need to do is win your own party and you don't have to think about the other half of the country, that creates a much more partisan side. This works on both sides, but there are some imbalances in the system that have given an advantage to Republicans precisely because they're in rural districts and they control more votes in the Senate. And so there is an imbalance that encourages, for a variety of reasons, encourages Republicans in particular to be more partisan.
But the lack of moral courage or principled stand within the Republican Party, it's just so sad to watch.
So this is a different subject. So certainly when Trump was president, and this was very clear, I wrote about this pretty extensively at the time of when he was impeached the first time. There were a few senior senators who would have had influence, and a few senior public officials like Mike Pompeo, who could have had influence on the president, who could have stood up and said what he's just done is illegal. They didn't. And there are one or two. Lindsey Graham was another. You know, there's a series of American senators who defended him, even though they were aware that he'd broken the law and that what he was doing was, you know, would have been impossible in any other presidency. And there was a wide range of reasons for this. I mean, some of them were opportunists. Some of them, like the characters in my book, have become so convinced that the U.S. left is so evil and so disastrous that whatever it takes, whoever is the leader, we have to stand behind them to make sure that the left doesn't take over. There's a mood like that. Some of them are frightened, and strange though it sounds, you know, a senior senator is somebody who has, you know, a great amount of power and prestige and money, and yet some of them are afraid of, or are, you know, they don't want to be attacked by Trump on Twitter, or they're afraid of Twitter mobs. Some of them are afraid of bad publicity, and they don't seem to have the nerve to stand out, you know, to stand up against it. I mean, we'll see what happened. I mean, we had in the last Congress, I mean, in the last few weeks, not in the last Congress, in this Congress, there are a few people who did vote, a few Republicans who did vote for Trump to be impeached the second time. And who are now, you know, who have come under attack from some part of their party and who are still standing up for themselves. I mean, Liz Cheney is the most famous one in the House of Representatives. And there are one or two senators, including Mitt Romney, but not only, as well. And we'll see what happens to them. I mean, if they are able to stay in office, if they're able to carry their voters, you know, if they're able to convince people that they're principled, then, you know, then there's hope that that those kinds of attitudes can win within the party.
How dangerous is the development in the Republican Party for the future of American democracy? I mean, some numbers indicate that 1/3 of Republican voters believe in this QAnon nonsense, and 60% believe that the election was stolen. I mean, these are serious and big numbers.
Yes. So one of the things that, again, it's important to understand about the January 6th events was what you saw there was not Republicans versus Democrats. That wasn't just partisanship. That was a part of the, you know, that was an anti-systemic part of the country fighting the system. And the system included Vice President Mike Pence, and it included, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and it included Congress and so on. And there is a disturbing number of people inside, you know, who are affiliated with or in the Republican Party, who are now anti-systemic, who don't believe in the electoral system, who believe in a wide variety of conspiracy theories instead. And yes, they are. It is an extremely dangerous movement, and it's not everybody in the party. It's not all of them. It's not even all the people who voted for Trump. But it is it's an important movement, and thinking about how to reach those people and how to bring them back into the public sphere is very important. Mm.
Some also argue that you should not forget the left and this development and much used term wokeness, cancel culture, etc. How dangerous is this movement seen from the left towards democracy in the US?
So it's a little bit of a different phenomenon. You know, again, I didn't write about it because that's not what my book was about. I mean, you know, there are many, many, many books about that. So it's not like we lack, you know, this subject. I may write a little bit more about this in the future, but, you know, I don't come from the left myself. I'm not based in a university. You know, it's not something that I knew or had personal, you know, contact with until recently.
But you did also sign Persuasion, the project Persuasion, which goes a bit into it, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I think I'm an advisor of Persuasion. It's right. Run by my friend Yasha Monk, and Yasha and I are actually teaching a course together this, right now on democracy. But it's not been my main area because it's not an area of my expertise, and so I haven't written about it a lot. But it's also a little bit different in that you know, it's very hard to explain what it is, but it's a movement of, you know, a desire for to end public debate on some issues in some U.S. universities, and it spread a little bit into journalism as well. And it's hard to, you know, it's hard to see, a little, it can be hard to separate what's bad about it from what's good about it. There's some elements that are good, you know, obviously, you know, better and deeper discussion of racism in American history, greater understanding of the role that sexual harassment plays and in making women feel uncomfortable in workplaces. I mean, all that has been good, and it's important to support. And then there's an edge that goes a little bit farther, but this is mostly a problem in certain kind of cultural institutions on the left. So, you know, universities, some media, some museums and other places. It's not a political movement in the same sense. I mean, they don't control the Democratic Party. You know, Joe Biden is not controlled by, you know, or influenced much by, the identity politics in U.S. universities. And so it's not a political issue in the same way. It is a big social and cultural issue, and it's one that's growing, particularly because the methods that are sometimes used by the proponents of, it's hard to even say, it's not an ideology, but so, you know, there's a set of ideas that they use and when people disagree with them or they say, I don't think we should do it this way or we shouldn't put it that way, then they're suspected of having ill motives. You know, you can't disagree. If you disagree, it means you're a racist. And that kind of, you know, that kind of conflict, you know, is a real end for political debate, and it is a huge problem. Mm. It isn't a political problem in the same way that the far right is a problem, I don't think. And also I should say, I mean, to my knowledge, it doesn't really exist in Europe in the same way. In Poland, we don't have it at all. In Hungary, it doesn't exist at all. And yet it's true that both the Polish and the Hungarian right sometimes talk about this threat from the cultural left in America as if it was their problem. And this is a completely fake and politicized way of, you know, trying to justify what it is that they do. And I don't even know. I mean, there's a bit of it in Britain, but it's not, you know, and there's an argument about it in France and so on. But I don't think it's, you know, you have to be careful to separate what's real, like where is the real problem, from, you know, the right's attempt to make this into a problem. And that's a whole minefield, kind of snake pit. But I mean, there's a real story there, and there are people who've suffered from, you know, having committed no crime, who lose their jobs for saying things that are considered, that used to be okay, that are now considered not okay. And that's a cultural problem that we need to find a language to talk about and a way to deal with. That's outside of politics. Mm.
But it certainly seems like the right in the U.S. is obsessed with them, watching Fox or whatever, and using it kind of.
The reason for that is that what Joe Biden is doing right now in the economy is very popular, and it's popular on the right as well. And this means that they have no arguments, you know. So if Joe Biden says, I want to spend a lot of money on infrastructure and I would like to raise corporate taxes to pay for it, turns out that's really popular. And it's popular inside the Republican Party. In fact, I saw a poll. I mean, I'm quoting off the top of my head, so I don't want to, maybe I've got this wrong. I don't have that in front of me. I saw one poll that seemed to say that when you tell people, you know, would you like a lot of money spent on roads and bridges, they say yes. And then when you ask them, and would you like us to tax very wealthy people in order to pay for it, they say they like it even more, you know. And so given that those things are all very popular and that's what he's doing now, the right needs some other tool with which they can bludgeon the left. And so they've landed on this thing called cancel culture, and they've made that into the main political issue of the moment. Mm. Whereas, as I said, I think there is a real problem. It exists in universities and some other institutions. I don't know that, when the right uses it as a talking point, when they try to create and increase these culture wars, that's not because they're trying to solve the problem. It's just because they're trying to distract people from the economic issues and the fact that most of what Biden's doing, they agree with. Mm.
Talking about the right and especially Fox News and the media situation in US, how important has the development been in the news media in the US for the eroding of the democracy in the US?
So it depends what you mean by the news media. I mean, there's some of the, you know, I think some of the best journalism that's ever been done has been done in the last 4 years. I mean, there's been a real flowering of good writing and good coverage. And there's been a revival of quality magazines and newspapers as people suddenly realize that they do need to subscribe to them if they want to keep getting good news. And so the economic fortunes of a lot of institutions have changed for the better in recent years. But, you know, the real change, of course, is to do with how people get their news. And the shift from newspapers and broadcasting, quite frankly, you know, to social media hasn't been good for the news, and it hasn't been good for public debate. And that's because the rules that govern online debate, and by the way, this is not just true in the US, this is true everywhere. The rules that govern online debate are not rules designed to encourage civilized conversation, you know, rational exchange of views. The way that, for example, Facebook decides what information to deliver into your newsfeed is that they use an algorithm, and the algorithm promotes things that are more emotional, things that will make you angry, things that you might agree with fervently, you know, and their idea is to use that. And the point of doing that is they want you to keep using Facebook and keep looking at advertising. So their business model is that they want you to be online as much as possible. And the business model is not necessarily good for democracy. It's not those aren't the values that we, you know, that's not how we want to promote news and information in the public sphere. And so I've recently written, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic that looked at what might be some of the alternatives. You know, could there be such a thing as public service social media, the way we have public service television, that had different values at its heart? Could there be a way of monitoring, you know, either inside or outside the platforms, monitoring the algorithms and trying to understand what it is that they're doing, so there's some transparency around them. Mm-hmm. Couldn't that be a way of, you know, ensuring that conversation is more civilized? So, I mean, I think there's no question that, you know, there's more and worse polarized media now than there used to be. I mean, I don't think it's inevitable that things have to be that way. But yes, it is. Both the economic trends and the technological trends have pushed us in that direction.
Mm. We're moving towards the end, and a final question from my part is about the current pandemic. Is there a danger that the state control and the kind of power that the state has during this pandemic, and understandably so, you need much state control to coordinate, but could this transform into a more authoritarian development? Should we be afraid of it?
So in some places it already has. You know, if you look around the world, places as varied as Hungary and India, you can see how the pandemic has been used by national and regional officials to keep control of people and to stay in power. And it's very possible that in some way, you know, in some places that will outlast the pandemic. I mean, there's a number of, you know, I've seen a number of different case studies of, you know, countries where, you know, whether it's taking control of people's data or whether it's physical control of people's movement. There's a danger that it could stay. I mean, there is also the opposite danger, which I don't know if you see it in Norway, but we can certainly see it in Germany. You know, we can certainly see a version of it in the US, which is that the controls put down under the pandemic create a kind of anarchic counter reaction. In other words, that people are against government control and they begin to fight government control. And for understandable reasons or sometimes less understandable reasons, become less likely to adhere to public safety measures simply because the frustration of being locked up for so long and told what to do is so great. I mean, so I think we could almost have, you know, it's very hard to say how the pandemic is going to play out in the politics of specific countries. I mean, in some cases we could have an anti-state reaction that plays itself out over the next few years as people object to being told what to do, having tolerated for the last year.
Mm. I know it's always dangerous to ask a historian about the future, but still, if you were to say something about liberal democracy and the development the next 10, 20 years, are you an optimist?
So here's how I would answer that. First of all, I don't predict the future. I think it's an impossible task. I would also say that although I am instinctively and kind of characterologically pessimistic, I think it's very irresponsible for people like you and me and most of this audience to be pessimistic. And what we're going to tell our children that everything's terrible and it's all going to get worse. You know, I don't think you can stand in front of an audience and say that. But the third thing I would say is that I think, you know, one of the mistakes that we've made over the last couple of decades is to assume that liberal democracy was inevitable, that because it was obviously the best system, that we didn't have to work that hard on it, you know, and that we could allow politics to be done by just a bunch of professional people over there and the rest of us could get on with whatever, making money or writing books. And we didn't have to worry about it. I mean, I hope that the events of the last few years have been a wake-up call and reminding people that civic engagement is part of how you make democracy work, and being involved in your community at local or national or regional levels is necessary for everybody. And I would also remind everybody that history is radically open. So, you know, that's not a pessimistic or an optimistic thing to say. So, yes, it's conceivable that liberal democracy could collapse, the EU could collapse, we could go back to a world of, you know, warring microstates. That's possible. That's one of our futures. It is also possible that we overcome the problems, that America reforms its constitution, that, you know, the transatlantic alliance and indeed the alliance of democracies around the world and, you know, in Asia and Africa and Latin America pull themselves together and work out how to push back against the authoritarianism, you know, that's growing from China and Russia. But, you know, being able to do that depends on how engaged people are, how focused we can be on the problems, and how much we can work together.
Anne Applebaum, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts from New York.
Thank you. Appreciate the invitation and have a lovely evening.
Let me once again extend my gratitude to the House of Literature for making this episode possible. Let me also thank you all for listening and remind you that we have numerous episodes in English, many of them with related themes to the one I discussed with Anne. You can access them through our archive on Liberal Halvtime. Before we end, if you support our work, and I hope you do, please rate our show on iTunes and feel free to leave a review. This will increase our audience outreach. If you have questions or comments or critique, please feel free to send me an email. My email is, as always, eric@civita.no. This concludes today's episode. Thanks for joining and have a great summer.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.